I find that the subjects of Christian renewal and Christian mission go right together. Because it has been in the times of the eras of awakening and vitality and new life in the church that great movements of mission, evangelism, of outreach, of Christian expansion have taken place. On the other hand, when the Christian church has been in pretty dry times, inward turning times, times of declension, times of kind of holding the fort, and that's about all that can be done, then you find that very often the outreach and missionary program of the church just withers away and dries up. So this morning we're going to have to do some little background, keeping in mind the eras of awakening and renewal, as then we try to come into the matter of mission and of outreach. When we talk about these eras of renewal, we are talking about fairly extensive movements. Movements that have lasted perhaps for five or six generations, which have covered a great deal of the existing Christianity of their period. They are movements that have had very obvious inner dynamic, movements that then have been oriented outward and which have had a tremendous impact on reaching people for Christ and making an impact on the society in which these Christians have been put. Perhaps it would be helpful if I just put on the board here behind us the great eras of renewal we're going to be talking about, and then we can sort of keep this as a framework in mind, because we will be alluding to this on occasion and assuming it at others, and it may be helpful. As I see the great movements of life in Christianity, they go something like this. Number one is what we could call the early church. And I would see this emerging right out of the New Testament. With that, we are fairly familiar. But it carries on, and I think often as Christian folk, once we come to the end of the New Testament, we don't know very much about what goes on after that. And of course, that's where Christian history picks up. It's after the end of the New Testament. I sometimes find in a first year history class that some students think that Christian history is Bible history. And I assign a history essay, and they want to write on Old Testament or New Testament history. But I have to say, no, Old Testament history comes under Old Testament, New Testament history comes under New Testament, church history is after the close of the New Testament. So that's the era we're talking about. As far as I see it, the vitality of the New Testament church carries on to perhaps around the year 300 A.D. And we're going to talk considerably this morning about this period and see what might be there that's relevant to our own day. In many ways, I think this period is closer to us than any of the intervening centuries. The kind of situation the church is in, the kind of issues it has to face, are really closer in many, many ways. And we'll try and expand that as we get into it. The second era of renewal that I see, I would describe by a word that probably as Protestant Christians we don't normally associate with movements of life in the church. And I would call this the era of early monasticism. Now, I'm sure that as Protestants, we have often got our opinions of monasticism from the age of the Reformation. And we remember how Luther and the other great men of the early 16th century, as they tried to cleanse the church in Western Europe, felt that monasticism was one of the worst things they had to deal with. If you remember your English history, can you remember back English history? 1539, the dissolution of the monasteries, getting rid of monasticism. That was one of the first steps in the Protestant Reformation in most of the Protestant lands. And you can go today to England and you'll see ruins all over. And that's the remains of some old monastery or other. Well, monasticism in the late Middle Ages and at the time of the Reformation certainly was a movement that had suffered a great deal of decline. But we are talking about a movement 1,000 or more years before that. And I think, to be fair, any movement can decline in 1,000 years. In fact, a lot of movements, it takes a lot less than 1,000 years. So if we can take our minds out of that period and go way, way back to a very early period, I would see early monasticism as a profound movement of life and vitality in the Christian church, running from about 350 to 475, but having a later and distinct manifestation in what is called the Celtic Church or Celtic Christianity, and that refers to Ireland. We have had some glorious Irish accents here this week, and we may get oriented a little bit to Ireland. Ireland has always been unique, and I'm sure some of us think that today, as well as any time in the past. It's always kind of done its own thing. And this was very, very true in the period that we are talking about. The influence of monasticism came late to Ireland, but when it came, it continued. And it continued longer than in other countries because it did not suffer some of the terrible pressures of the barbarian invasions that Christianity was suffering around the Mediterranean and in Western Europe at this time. And also there did seem to be a profound dynamic within Irish Celtic Christianity. And so we would particularly see the Celtic period as a late form of early monasticism, probably at its best running from about 550 on to 725, somewhere in that era when the rest of Christianity is going through one of its most difficult periods, over there in Ireland is flowering a remarkable Christianity. It almost takes your breath away how great and magnificent it really was. So we would see that as the second era. The third, I would call the High Middle Ages. And this runs from about 1075 to 1250. There has been a great decline in Christianity after the era of the Celtic Church. It is largely, again, related to the barbarian invasions. And finally, that last and worst form of barbarianism, the Vikings from Scandinavia, who just swept across Western Europe and decimated virtually everything. And it sometimes is healthy for Christianity to have a bit of persecution, but you can't have too much. You got to have a kind of moderate persecution. But when it's the kind of persecution that just wipes the slate clean, then it is pretty, pretty rugged indeed. And this was part of what was happening. However, once the Vikings get settled down, and we come to know them as the Normans in Normandy in western France, Once William the Conqueror hops across the English Channel, 1066 and all that, and the Normans get settled in England, then it seems as if Western Europe is ready for a new breath of God's Spirit. And that certainly comes in what is often called the era of the High Middle Ages. This awakening also has a very major monastic input and then has characteristics of its own. Once again, after this period, there is the long religious Christian decline of what is called the Late Middle Ages. And that brings us to the era that we may be a bit more familiar with, and that is the era of the Reformation. And in very rough terms, we think of this running from about 1500 to, say, 1660. And here all of us, of course, every day as Protestant Christians live in the heritage of the Reformation movement. That movement, however, again went into decline. Then another movement of awakening emerges, and this is what is usually called the evangelical. Movement, and it is often marked from the year 1735, which is the year in which George Whitefield, who would be the first great evangelist in England of the movement, is converted, and also the year in which Jonathan Edwards in the American colonies in western Massachusetts would experience a reviving in his congregation, which set off a great deal of prayer and desire to see this emulated in other parts, particularly the English-speaking world. And then, of course, very soon John Wesley comes on track, and we think of this whole evangelical movement. It's out of this era, of course, that the Brethren movement is going to arise about 90 years after the start of it. John Nelson Darby and George Mueller and others of the founders of the Brethren movement. You know, so it is going to come directly out of this evangelical era. And I hope tomorrow morning we can talk a little bit about that. And I hope I can learn some things from you folks as how you see your origins. It will be very helpful to me in doing that. When does the evangelical movement start to decline? We are not saying when does it pass out of existence. Of course, it doesn't. But we are talking here about these movements in their strong major phase, not in their recessive period. We are still close enough to the evangelical movement that it's sometimes a little hard to pin down, but I would tend to say somewhere before World War I, somewhere in the very early part of this century, or maybe in the late 1890s, let's put 1914, certainly as the very latest date. And then, of course, evangelical Protestantism starts or exhibits its slide amazingly, so that within 10 years, evangelical Christians can't believe what's happened. They were strong and flourishing and powerful in the 19th century and in many places up till 1914. And then you were just on the toboggan slide. And by the mid-1920s, evangelical Protestantism is some archaic vestigial remain of something that seems so old and so out of it and absolutely passé. Amazing how things can change in history so rapidly. You think something is strong and settled, and then winds come along, winds of destruction or winds of life, and just turn everything around in a very, very brief period of time. The question, of course, comes, where are we today? And I was fascinated to find at the Bible College, this is the question people wanted to talk about. Where are we today? Where do we sort of see ourselves standing in the flow of Christian history? Are we in an upturn day or are we a downturn day? Is that going to influence our strategy? Our tactics? Are they going to be influenced by where we see ourselves standing in Christian history? Or do we always do the same thing in every era? These are kind of questions we certainly have to ask ourselves in our own Christian assemblies, congregations, ministries. Where has God in His providence put us to live? And our ministry, is it in any way determined by what we see going on about us and what seems to be going on worldwide in the scheme of God's purposes? All right, this morning we want to start here anyway. I'm not sure how far we'll get, but we'll start here. We want to look at the early church. We want to look at its mission. We want to look at its outreach. If you are at all interested in reading in this field, and as I said, I believe it is an extremely relevant field to us because there are many areas in which the Christianity of the 20th century is more parallel with the Christianity of this early period than of any other, I would suggest the book of Michael Green called Evangelism in the Early Church. I don't know if any of you have read other books of Michael Green. He has written many popular presentations of the Christian faith. He is one of those fascinating people who is what you might call a scholarly popularizer. And in a person like Michael Green, it's a very effective combination. It means he knows the basic scholarly issues. At the same time, he has a wonderful capacity of making it relevant to people. Has Michael Green ever ministered here in Australia? He's never been. You'll never forget him if you do. He is an Anglican clergyman who is just full of life and vitality. He just is always pouring out what he has to give. He has taught. He has been principal of an Anglican Theological College in Nottingham in England. He is now the rector of St. Aldett's Church in Oxford. If any of you have been around Oxford, just right by the university, it is having an amazingly effective ministry. So he's a man who is able to sort of pull the academic and the practical worlds together in a wonderful way. And so this book of his, Evangelism in the Early Church, is of great help. I would recommend it. You won't get bored by it. Michael is the sort of person who couldn't be dull if he even tried. Isn't it wonderful to have some Christians like that? Some of us can't do anything else but be dull. But Michael is one of these guys who just always has the spark about whatever he's presenting and has a wonderful way of making it interesting. If you want to get beyond Michael Green, if some of you really get into this subject and feel this is very relevant, I think the best work is by one of the great German scholars of the early part of this century, Adolf von Harnack. Now, we often think of Harnack as a very liberal theologian. He was that, but he was also a great historian. And his work on the expansion and growth of Christianity in the first three centuries certainly still merits careful reading, although it was written many decades ago. I think probably the thing we should look at first is the difficulties the early church had in its mission and its outreach. The first and most obvious, and it always commented on, is that Christianity was illegal. Now, it would seem to me that in our world today, when Christianity is illegal, we often almost throw up our hands and say there's nothing obviously can be done. This certainly wasn't the case in the early church. They realized the government had put this ban upon them, and yet that certainly did not halt their Christian witness. In fact, they never even seemed to raise the question that maybe because the government had prohibited them, therefore they really ought to close down. Now, it's perfectly true that the Roman government was a very wise kind of government. It did not seek to hassle its citizens unless it really had to. And there are important periods in which Christians are not persecuted in this early period. And even when persecution did come, it often only came in certain areas. But the threat of persecution is always there. It would lash out at certain periods, and it certainly put the Christian church in the shade as far as the government was concerned and as far as the opinion of many people is concerned. Another difficulty that the early church had in its outreach ministry was that people in society had a very dim view of Christianity for various reasons, not just the illegal one we've mentioned. Certain Christian practices. Christians did not participate in many of the public and social events of their day. They did not do this because they felt compromise was involved. They felt if they went to eat in the homes of many non-Christians, there were domestic gods there in the homes to which some kind of recognition was given, and they felt that they might be getting involved in some kind of polytheistic worship. And so Christians often did not take part in normal channels of social intercourse. Therefore, many people felt that Christians were misogynists, that they were haters of the human race. You know, they wouldn't have anything to do with people. You know, well, what kind of a religion is this? These people set off by themselves in their own little holy huddle. They must have awful opinions of the rest of mankind if that's the way they act. This obviously is a great hurdle for Christianity to overcome. And yet, what could the early Christians do? At the very essence of their faith, the worship of one God. If you're in danger of acknowledging the presence and reality of other gods, this is a very fundamental issue that Christians had to face. Then there were aspects of Christian worship, which certainly caused questions in the wider society. The Lord's Supper. Broken bread and poured out wine representing the blood of Christ. If the people outside didn't know too much about you as Christians and had rather dim views of you anyway, it was fairly easy to interpret this in the worst way possible. And what was that? That these Christians were really cannibals. That's what they were doing at these quiet, almost hidden services. After all, they're illegal. They've got to keep a low profile. You know, the way rumors can spread, the way ideas... What are people doing in that little gospel hall? You know, you could sort of translate it in today's world. What does the outside person think? He gets one little bit of data, and he interprets that wrongly, but then he's off to the races from there. And this is the kind of thing that was happening to the early church. Then, frequently in the early church, they had a service called a love feast. What do our Christian words sometimes convey? You know, to us, a love feast, well, that's sharing the love of Christ That's the agape of God towards us. But that isn't always what it suggested to the non-Christian in this era. After all, if they thought these people were misogynists, if they thought they were cannibals, you were ready to believe almost anything about them. And of course, when they talked about love feasts, they believed they were orgiastic, that they had wild sexual orgies. That's what they did at love feasts. These are all difficulties that early Christianity had to overcome, the perceptions that people had of them. Another difficulty was that the early church was called by God to minister in a largely urban setting. So are we today. In the intervening centuries, this has not been largely so. The Christian church, largely being a European body, has been ministering to people in basically rural settings, agrarian settings. It seems to be largely held today that it is much more difficult for the Christian church to minister in the urban world than in the rural world. But again, the early church doesn't seem to have been particularly bothered by this. They move ahead and move ahead effectively within an urban cultural setting. What were some of the difficulties that urban society presented to them? Well, it's a society of subcultures. And in the cities of the Roman Empire, as we are reminded from Acts chapter 2 and the day of Pentecost, it's a very cosmopolitan world. People are there from all sorts of backgrounds. Urban society is usually a fairly sophisticated society. It's a society in which people have lots of alternatives to indulge their interests. It's not a society where people have lots of time on their hands with nothing to do. Competition is rife for people's attention. This is the kind of world in which the early church moved. And at least accepted wisdom says that's a tough society in which to minister Jesus Christ. Religiously, it was an era of breakdown and syncretism. Many of the older religions seemed to be coming to an end, and it was kind of do-it-yourself era in religion. You know, take a bit from here, a bit from here, a bit from there. Make your own mix. Kind of make your own religion. Again, it seems to be felt in many areas that our prevalent kind of religious syncretism is a great hindrance, a great difficulty for Christianity. Well, once again, that was very much the kind of world the early church had to face. The religions, of course, were different from our own day, but the attitude that, religion, yeah, we may need a bit of it, but we sort of are ourselves the determiners of what that will be, so we pick and choose as we go along. Enough, I think, on the difficulties of the early church. Let's look at what we might call the providential setting of the early church. The world in which God set them, and the world that contains certain positive bridges for them to move into the non-Christian world. And it did not take the early church too long before some of its people were recognizing these providential bridges and were certainly stressing them. Now, I think that many times Christians use the providential bridges of their era without being conscious of it. And that's fine, but there's no harm in looking around at your society and saying, as the early church found, did, that there were certain things that God had built into that society that could be used in particularly effective communication of Jesus Christ. What were some of these? One was the language. In the Roman Empire, there was a common language. It wasn't Latin, it was Greek. Latin's going to be developing on as time proceeds, but Greek is the one common language. And so, Christians made great use of that. And of course, in our day, in mission, some people are arguing that we now have a kind of universal lingua franca, and that is the English language. Up until a generation ago, it was usually thought that French was the universal language, at least of diplomacy, and oftentimes of international commerce and business. But that seems to have switched, and some people seem today to be using that. Are there other ways that we can apply this same kind of principle? Then it was felt that the government itself, unintentionally, had provided a helpful context for the early church, and that was the Pax Romana, the peace that Rome provided throughout its empire by its strongly centralized form of government, by its excellent military forces, by its sensitive understanding of logistics, by all sorts of things. Rome was an excellent government. Here was peace, and so the Christians were going to move in that kind of world effectively. Then there was Roman engineering, what this had done for travel in terms of shipping, in terms of roads, and how the Christians are constantly moving along these avenues that the technology of the early church era had provided for them. Also, the Christians were aware in this period that God in His providence had so ordered things that they were in a period, as we've mentioned, of religious breakdown, of a great deal of fear, of a lot of searching on the parts of people. Now, 99 people out of 100 were not turning to Christianity for the answer. But at least it was a society in which a lot of people were looking for answers. And the early church found that was a wonderful day in which to be ministering Jesus Christ. So, there was an awareness, at least to some extent, of these providential situations that God had put them in. Now, what about some of the methods that the early church uses? First of all, the quality of life of the Christians. The rise of Christianity in the Roman Empire is a subject that always fascinates a certain number of historians of the ancient world. And in this last decade and a half, there have been a number of important studies in this area by historians, as far as I know, who are not Christians. They don't have any particular axe to grind. They are just fascinated by this important development of how Christianity grew, a most important historical reality. And again and again, as these historians try to figure out, sift the data, as historians do, try and understand why this great movement of Christianity rose from almost nothing within a couple of hundred years to a position of tremendous strength against all its difficulties, the quality of life of the Christians always comes through right at the very heart of their consideration. A number of matters are talked about here, and we certainly haven't got time to go into them all. One, however, is the attitude to unwanted children. One of the forms of birth control in the Roman world was abandoning unwanted children on the local refuse heap. This was accepted custom, unquestioned, until the Christians came along. And Christians, with their awareness of the value of life as made in God's image and as redeemed by Jesus Christ, just could not stand this. And there's this instinctive, immediate reaching out of Christians in a thoroughly unplanned way to these unwanted children, taking them in, bringing them into their homes. And here we get the beginning of the longest standing form of Christian social ministry, and that's the orphanage. And of course, you folk in the Brethren have had great orphanage people. One, of course, thinks of Mueller himself, and then you think of Fagan, and you think of Barnardo, and lots of others of these famous Brethren of the 19th century, and some of these organizations still continuing. This tremendous concern about children, unwanted children, abandoned children, abused children, as we talk about them in our day. Right at the very beginning of the Christian era, Christians moved in this kind of direction. And this drew people, because there were many people in society who were troubled by this. They didn't know what to do about it. They didn't do what the Christians did. But they were certainly impressed when the Christians began to do something about what they obviously saw was a problem, but didn't know how to even begin to start resolving it. Another area of attraction about early Christianity was its domestic life. The commitment and fidelity and love of husbands and wives and of parents and children. In any society in breakdown, social breakdown, regardless of how strong the government may be, that is experiencing religious social breakdown, the family is going to feel it. The family is going to be fractured. And in the midst of that kind of situation, here was the Christian family. And what a drawing power it was. Not to everyone. If you read some of the feminist historians of our day, you will find how they just lash out at what they think the early church did to deprive women of certain rights. And there's a certain element of truth in that. But there were all kinds of women and people and families in the world of the early church that were not so concerned about rights as they were concerned about the maintenance and the wholeness of domestic life. And to such people, and it seems there were a great many of them, Christianity had a magnetic attraction to people who were looking for a solution to the whole problem of the family. Those are two areas. I mean, there are lots of others we could talk about. Christians won a lot of praise from people because of the way they cared for their dead. I'm not sure that's particularly relevant in our day, but the world of the first few centuries was a world that was very much concerned about how you handled your dead, how you buried them, and so on. So we can probably not need to go into that. Then, if the quality of life of the Christians was significant, then also their means of communication. The first is the mobilization of the whole community. Christianity spreads in large measure. Christians in relation to their extended family, Christians in relation to neighbors, Christians in relation to business. The whole Christian community is involved. Christianity grew through traveling ministries. Ministries of apostles and prophets, and then, as it seems, the apostle and prophet ministry begins to phase out, then more the ongoing ministry of those we might well call evangelists. How important. Again, low key. I mean, you couldn't have a Billy Graham or anything like this when Christianity is illegal. The evangelist has to be a much more low profile, low key kind of person. And a person who's always on the move. Couldn't stay too long in any one place. I was reading Peter Lynham's volume, There They Found Brethren. Do any of you know it, the history of the assembly? The chairman of the CBRF in New Zealand, and is it in Palmerston North. As I read through that book of his when it came out a few years ago and then went through it again in New Zealand a couple of weeks ago, I was immediately struck by something. And that was that the Brethren movement in New Zealand in its period of great growth from, say, 1880 to 1920 just had all kinds of peripatetic evangelists. And so I turned to somebody and said, who are your evangelists today in New Zealand Brethren? They said, maybe we've got one. And I said, that's very, very significant and maybe very serious. Maybe that's why you're not growing. It seems that the pattern, certainly, of the early church is that a body of low-key, mobile evangelists is certainly part of any strong growth movement. There were other people involved in the outreach ministry, and these were involved in literary ministry. This begins with the writings of a group of people called the Apologists, of whom Justin Martyr happened to him, of whom Justin Martyr is the most prominent. And these people communicated the Christian faith in literary form, and they were not just writing gospel tracts. They were writing all kinds of literature, however, that had a relation to the Christian faith. They are apologists. They are offering the Latin use of the word apologia. I didn't mean they were being apologetic, but they were offering reasons why Christianity should be considered. This is another part of the growth of the early church in its methodology. Time's tearing away. What was the result of this? Well, the result was growing from a handful. By the year 300, with all the oppositions we have mentioned and difficulties, the Christian church had become the most significant entity in the Roman Empire apart from the government itself. It may have risen to be about 10% of the population. And if you get 10% of the population mobilized, you've got something very, very effective. I was interested. Somebody in New Zealand said to me a couple of weeks ago with a great downturn of the lip, in New Zealand, only 13% of the people attend church regularly. Goodness, I thought in the early church they would have been dancing a Highland Fling if they could have got 13%. They would have, you know, this is the overwhelming minority. If you have a minority of people who really know where they're going, you certainly don't need 51% to make a very, very strong impact upon the society in which we're living. Okay, now, I see I've gone on very, very long on this section. I think we ought to call it here and probably open up for discussion. And then we have tea break in, what, 15 minutes? Okay. So let's take a minute just to relax, take a few breaths, put your thoughts together.
What was the form of government of that early church? Was it a Presbyterian form of government?
I wonder if I ought to pass on that one. I think, to be fair, we would have to say it was an episcopal form of government, and none of us are Anglicans here, so I guess we could be fair, but it was a what we might call a Presbyterianized form of episcopacy, insofar as the bishop was really the leading elder, and that was how he emerged. It does seem that in the earliest form of the early church that you did have a plurality of eldership and a parity of eldership, and then the one elder largely involved in ministry and in the central congregation as the satellite congregations begin to develop, then you begin to get the emergence of the bishop as distinct from the elders, and yet for a long time still being kind of the first among equal of the elders. Then, of course, we could also say that there is a strongly congregational element in the early church, in that the leadership, the recognition of elders and so on comes from the congregation. Now, those are usually thought of as the three major forms of Christian government, the episcopal, the presbyterial, the congregational, and I think to some extent they are all present in the early church. Now, I am not quite sure if any of those are brethren government. No, I mean that very seriously. Is brethren government not more oligarchical government? And that is an oversight, a self-perpetuating oversight, which is not elected by the people? Is that right? If that is the case, then I suppose brethrenism is a fourth form of church government. You might find some of that in the early church too. I'm not sure.
You described the early church as being an illegal institution. I'm not convinced that description could apply to the church in the book of Acts. Would you like to respond to that?
Yes, this is very good to be true. And as we mentioned, that's New Testament. And here, when we talk about early church, we're talking about growing out of the New Testament, but really starting from about the year 100. Even by the year 100, Christianity is not yet specifically illegal. But very soon after that, and right around that time, Christianity is being recognized as a definite, distinct religious body and is not being recognized by the government. In the New Testament, Christianity was sheltering under the umbrella of Judaism. And the Romans had made certain concessions to Judaism, which made it legal within certain civil and religious restrictions. So that you might say that Judaism did not have full religious liberty in the Roman world, but it did have toleration, if you can make the distinction between what liberty is and what toleration is. So for three quarters of a century or so, Christianity got on under that umbrella. But as the Christian church began to develop, and as the government saw that it was quite distinct, and that Judaism was opposed to Christianity, Christianity was not granted the legal status that Judaism was. And so, perforce, it was a non-recognized religion. Sorry, one here, and then we'll come on back here. Yeah. Oh, okay. Okay. Go ahead, sir.
Just with reference to what you just said regarding Judaism and Christianity, I think you'll have emphasized at another place that it was seen that Christianity was becoming international in the sense that Judaism really wasn't.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes, indeed. That is very true. You felt that Judaism would stick pretty much to its own people. Christianity is moving out in a dynamic way, and that causes a lot more fear. Yeah, this man right here.
Did any of the world religions that we know of today have any impact in the religious scene of that time?
You're thinking of the religions like Buddhism and Islam particularly. Islam was not in existence. It will not come for another 6 or 7 centuries. So it is not in the picture. The peoples in the Arabian Peninsula and so on that we think of as the heart and core of Islam were animistic peoples, very much like the barbarian people of Northern Europe in their religion. Hinduism and Buddhism are in operation and are part of large and thriving cultures of which the Roman world knows almost nothing. There are trade links, but the trade routes went so far in terms of the technologies of the day that there really wasn't much interaction in terms of the great religions. Probably the only one that would exist today as an option would be some form of Zoroastrianism, which was in Persia, and which early Christians had some contact with and which survives today in the Jain sect around Bombay in India. That would really be about the only thing. You are rather dealing with religions of the ancient Middle East and Near East. Oh, sorry. No.
What possible support is there in history for the claim that Peter was the first bishop of Rome?
What kind of evidence is there in history that Peter was the first bishop of Rome? Evidence seems to be fairly ancient that Peter went to Rome, that Peter was crucified in Rome, that Peter asked for a special kind of crucifixion as his form of death, and that Peter was obviously a leader in the church in Rome. Now, beyond that, of course, we are working with a historical development, and that is the development of the place of the leadership of the Church of Rome into a highly recognized position, and then over centuries into what has been regarded in Western Christianity as the papacy. Most of us would tend to look and say there is a great difference between the claims and position accorded the Bishop of Rome by the 6th century from the position of the leadership of the Church of Rome in the 1st century. And we would see it as a historical development. With Roman Catholics, of course, it is an article of faith that there has been the development of what is called apostolic succession, and that is that the apostles to whom were given all the gifts of the Spirit, and then they in turn bestowed these upon the church after the Acts 8 formula, that this apostolic power and charisma was handed on through the laying on of hands, but of course by the presence of the Spirit through the laying on of hands, to the successive leaders of the church and bishops. So that bishops are charismatic figures, bishops are apostles, and have all the gifts and authority and power of apostles. Now, this is a Roman Catholic article of faith. This to the Roman Catholics makes them a New Testament church. The brethren have said, we're a New Testament church. The Catholics are wanting to say exactly the same thing. We're a New Testament church. We have apostles living right here today who have all the authority and power of apostles. And that's how the Spirit is given. We're a charismatic church. We've got apostles and so on here in the church today. Great claims. These are theological claims. I sympathize profoundly with what the Roman Church is trying to do through those claims in making itself a New Testament biblical church. Historically, I can't see the links how they get there. I'm very interested in what they're trying to do by those assertions, although I may not agree with the way they do it.
Is it right that there wasn't really a bishop of Rome at the time, say that Ignatius was bishop at Antioch, wasn't he? And that was after Peter's day.
Yes, well, Ignatius is bishop of Antioch, but around the time of Ignatius, we have the writings of Clement, who is called bishop of Rome. But again, many of us would see bishop there as kind of a leading elder, an elder largely giving himself to a more public kind of ministry, although probably not full time. There are very little opportunity for people to be ministering full time that early around the period of the Apostolic Fathers to which you are referring, right around the year 100, on both sides of that. So there certainly could be the development of a kind of plural episcopacy, if you want to put it that way, although even a kind of monarchical episcopate can be seen to emerge at that day. I would still see that as a long way from the claims being made for the Bishop of Rome as you get them in the mid-500s. Okay, I think it's tea time, isn't it? Yeah.
I have a question for you which I might like you to think about, not to answer now. It seems you had a preaching ministry and a teaching ministry, and the teaching ministry particularly in the writing.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like an assessment of the preaching as against the teaching, or the teaching as against the preaching. Because I think that's a very real situation for us today. It's very easy to get into a church these days where teaching becomes the emphasis, as against your suggestion even early on that it was mainly through preaching and travelling preachers. And you're right, I think, that the New Zealand assessment is true of ourselves, that we probably couldn't think of a lot of preachers who just travel around, but maybe we think of a lot more of teachers, and I think of these maybe as apologists,
mm-hmm.
in the tradition of apologists. All right, look, let's not take any more time.
We continue now with the question that Ken Newton just asked. These are the questions that preceded the second lecture, and we're using this little bit of tape that's left to just give you the questions in one flow.
To know whether we carry on more with the presentations or continue interacting with questions, I think it might be good if we spend a few more minutes on questions, and then we will proceed. Ken, you had one that you just raised. Do you want to come up and verbalize it, and then we can try and respond to it for a few minutes?
And maybe therefore teaching the faith and learning it, and that kind of presentation, as against the more peripatetic wandering around of preachers. Now, can you see any difference in a church which is led by either of those different forces?
Okay, thank you, Ken. That's great. Yes, we didn't mention that in the early church there were traveling teachers, as well as the traveling evangelists. It would seem to me that a wonderful sign of the health of the early church was that it had both. It has both evangelists and teachers. I guess I was troubled when I read Peter Lynham's book and heard at the same time the plaints of many of the New Zealand brethren about the spiritual life of their community. Well, was this not a fairly obvious problem, that it was becoming unbalanced, that there was a strong teaching emphasis, but a low evangelistic emphasis? Now, it would be just as much a danger if it were the other way. If it were all evangelism, and I'm sure a lot of you grew up in that, I hear over the years from many young brethren so fed up at the Sunday night gospel meeting, when 52 Sunday nights a year, to all Christians, the gospel meeting was held. I think part of what I picked up is a reaction against that. Saying, there's no point preaching the gospel every Sunday night when there are no unsaved present, so let's teach. But the problem is then you have two teaching services a Sunday, and there's never any evangelism done. So I suppose the early church would provide us with the healthy balance of having both teachers and evangelists. The thing is, of course, in today's society, it may not be the wandering, peripatetic, traveling evangelist that's needed. It may be new forms of evangelism that operate more meaningfully in our given situation. But it would seem whenever the church loses evangelists, it's in problem. It will be a declining movement. It may have wonderful teaching. It may have esoteric teaching. But I think it will be a declining movement. And that's not saying anything against teaching, it's only saying that ministry must be held in balance. So I think that's where I'd want to come in on that one and just give an encouragement to discovering new forms of evangelism, which would seem to be very much needed in our day. Yes?
Well, we're looking at house evangelism. Was there any experience of that sort of thing in the New Testament church? And also, is there a relationship between a lot of the people within the New Testament churches being evangelists rather than just specific people? You know, was there more people doing evangelists other than just the ones who were specifically appointed?
Good. Okay. That follows through, I think, very well. I will plead again for language. I'm not talking about the New Testament church because I'm not competent to do it. I'm talking about the early church after the New Testament era. But let's forget about that from here on, just to nail down where we are. I think what we tried to point out was that in the communication in the early church, the whole community was mobilized to do it. So it certainly isn't an either or. It isn't that there are evangelists, so thank God, then I can goof off and do nothing because the evangelists are going to do the job. No. It's the total Christian community is involved in sharing the faith, and then the ministry of the evangelist becomes particularly effective. The ministry of an evangelist in the early church was not a substitute for the Christians doing their job. It was a complement. And it seems to me that is when evangelism does become particularly effective. I remember speaking to a pastor friend of mine in the city of Vancouver in Western Canada, where we lived for about 20 years. And he came out of a Mennonite background. Now, if you know anything of the history of the Mennonites, for about 400 years they were persecuted and inevitably became very much of a ghetto. And yet, Willingdon Mennonite Brethren Church was just reaching people in the Burnaby suburb of Vancouver for Christ by the hundreds. And I said one day to the pastor, Herb Neufeld, I said, Herb, how is it that your congregation, with all its history that would point the other way, is doing such a wonderful job of reaching people for Jesus Christ? And Herb is a great pastor, a great big loving guy. He just stands here and envelops us all in his love, and his congregation sort of loves him back in return. But he's not the kind of guy to make, you know, flip quick answers. He sat and thought about it for a while. And he said, I think we're reaching people for Christ because for a lot of people in our congregation, evangelism is a way of life. That they were just naturally sharing Jesus Christ wherever they went. And then it was interesting to notice that they are constantly, nonetheless, training people in evangelism, having evangelists in. So it's the complementarity of the body of Christ evangelizing and then the special ministry of evangelists, and it all seems to go together very well. Okay, the house church movement, yeah, certainly in this period, you could only exist in house churches. Now, admittedly, by the middle of the 3rd century, although Christianity is still illegal, it's getting so strong at times they're building churches. And then the next persecution, they all get knocked out. Then they build them again. For at least 150 years after the end of the New Testament era, Christianity is basically a house church movement. There is no doubt about it that the house church can become an effective means of evangelism. It doesn't necessarily. Much of the house church movement I have seen, we have very little of it in Canada, but I have seen it in the UK, can get very turned in upon itself and become a ghetto, can become so concerned about what I would call ecclesiastical questions, that there in the house church they are doing everything according to the proper New Testament order, that they're not doing any evangelism. So house churches do not necessarily produce evangelism, but they can be a very effective means. I think rather than calling them house churches, I'd rather call them house groups, because it seems to me, as you look around today, the most effective kind of ministries are going on where people are part of a larger fellowship and also part of a smaller house fellowship. And they have worship and teaching and encouragement and perspective given by the larger, and then they bring a lot of that into the smaller. I think the danger of having all your Christian life in a house group is that you can often go hurtling off into all kinds of tangents without the balance that the larger fellowship will give you. In the early church, this balance was often preserved by the traveling people. They provided the balance wheel kind of things. Okay, one other question that was written out here, and I think again comes into this. Let me read it if I can. In the light of possible parallels between the early church and today, specifically use of social conditions, that's peace, mobility, Roman tolerance, so on, to what extent should the Christian church of today use facilities, money, and support to initiate and develop an outreach into the community via social areas? Specifically, our governments are concerned with large numbers of dropouts from institutionalized education and are offering relatively large sums of money for the development of programs aimed at retrieval for the benefit of society. Can the Christian Church utilize these opportunities to initiate appropriate programs with an intrinsic spiritual content aimed at developing the whole person? Well, certainly in the early church, the government wasn't funding anything the church was doing. So we can't see that direct kind of parallel. But we are being asked to seek the parallels that the early church did use, what bridges were available to it, and therefore in that kind of principle, could we maybe see some direction today? In reading this, I was reminded of an experience a week and a half ago with some people from the Te Atatu Assembly in Auckland. And we had been talking, not so much historically, we'd been talking contemporaneously, which we'll be doing, I hope, this evening, about some of the evidences of God's work in our own day. And some of these folk from Te Atatu came up after, and they said, we are engaged in at least three of the things you talked about. And two of these were small groups reaching out in the community. And the third one was social involvement. Now here the question is about education. They being in, I gather, a sort of a lower economic part of Auckland, have felt that their great pressure is the unemployed. And I gather the New Zealand government is offering funds for any group of people who will try to do something for the unemployed. So the Te Atatu Assembly has one of their people who is in full-time ministry within the assembly, and I gather they have quite a few in that category, who gives about a third of his time to working among the unemployed, and they have now, I think he said, 24 unemployed people working on various projects, which they get government funding for. It requires the Christians, of course, to provide the leadership, to provide the creativity, to provide the dynamic, the structure, and to provide the salary of someone who will lead it. And these people from Te Atatu were saying the number of people who come to Christ through this. Because everybody in the community said, here's somebody who's doing something about unemployment. Let's go and find out about it. And so not only have they been addressing a social need with the government's financial help, but they've been finding it's a wonderful means of outreach and evangelism. So it might be good for some of you to be in touch with your brethren across the Tasman and see what you can learn from each other. Because it seems to me that they're doing exactly this kind of thing. Although this question refers to education, education is often a more sensitive area because you're dealing with children and parents. Usually want to have lots of input there, and what input can Christians have? And whereas you're dealing with the unemployed, often the government's so desperate that they do anything